You're listening to The Leonard LoPate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Over the past 25 years, as a reporter, columnist, and blogger, Amy Alexander has covered disasters, civil unrest, and the recurring issue of racial policies and politics in American newsrooms. Now she's written a book called Uncovering Race, a Black Journalist's Story of Reporting and Reinvention. It's published by Beacon Press, and I'm very pleased that it has brought her back to our show. Hello, it's good to see you again.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
When you first began as a journalist, was it your dream to write a book?
It was not. It was kind of, you know, I mean, obviously I knew that people who were journalists write books, but that wasn't my goal. My goal was to be a really good reporter and to retire happy from the newspaper business.
And I'd imagine that if you did even think about it, it wouldn't have been this book.
It would not have been. And, you know, I began writing books about a year 10 or 12 as a journalist, and it was sort of a natural evolution, I suppose, but it also was something that I very consciously did because I was becoming somewhat burnt out, really, with daily journalism, which is funny to think now. At the time, I felt that the pace of it was not sustainable because I was a flat-out journalist, and to do it the right way takes a lot of time and energy, so I wanted to do long-form journalism.
Although that also suggests that you were a success.
Well, in my mind,
if you're running around all the time covering stories,
right.
Then
well, that's
you're
true.
One of the people that is relied on. Where did you begin your career?
In my hometown of San Francisco, and that would have been in the mid '80s, and it was fun. It was very busy. There still are kind of two papers there, but at the time there were definitely two big papers: the Morning Chronicle, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the Afternoon Examiner, which was owned by the Hearst family at that time.
And
I worked at the Examiner.
There are no afternoon papers anymore.
No.
So what was the staff makeup? Was there a lot of diversity at the San Francisco Examiner when you started there?
There was gender diversity. I'd say there were quite a number of women and women editors, but there was not a lot of ethnic diversity. Interestingly enough, there was sort of a wide range of class diversity. It's important that you have not only ethnic diversity in news organizations, particularly in the management ranks, but also people who have different life experiences, who are not all from one, you know, economic level.
So that sounds like it was pretty good.
It was fun. It was challenging because I was the only African-American woman on the Metro staff for almost 2 years. There were two Black men on the staff. And as you are maybe aware, the San Francisco Bay Area is really ethnically diverse.
Although Oakland has a much larger African-American community.
Oakland does.
And it has its own newspaper.
It does, the Tribune. And at that time, the Tribune was very robust. We very much saw them as a competitor. The situation at the Examiner, though, was interesting because what I found during my time there is that the kind of the sort of skepticism about my skills level and my ability to be a real and a skilled journalist came not so much from the older reporters who were white and male, but from the sort of my peer group, those who were around my same age or a little bit older.
And why do you think that is?
Well, I chalk it up to maybe just kind of, you know, you're competitive in general, and maybe you don't really see someone who is very different from you, meaning a woman and a Black person, as being able to accomplish what you think you're able to accomplish. It was a very odd and amorphous kind of thing, but I felt it and experienced it.
Hasn't there been a debate over the years of whether Black reporters should be sent to cover stories involving Black people or racial issues? Was that something that came up at the San Francisco Examiner?
Yeah, it did. And almost every news organization I've worked in the last 20-odd years, that's been, it's just touchy. It's somewhat of a third rail. And when I began in newspapers, I did not want to be a minority affairs reporter. I wanted to be just sort of a generalist. As you mentioned in your intro, I enjoyed covering like disasters because when you grow up and you're born in Northern California, there's disaster all the time.
So there's always a potential earthquake.
There's a potential earthquake, and then there are real earthquakes. And then there are sort of the civic unrest that can happen at any moment, as we just saw the other day in Oakland. with the Occupy Wall Street Oakland blow up.
And that wasn't a racial issue.
It was not. But I actually just wrote a column on my online column, Amy Alexander Community Forum, a couple of days ago. You know, the streets of Oakland, San Francisco, and Berkeley have for a long time been locations where, you know, people protest and march. And whether it's around student issues or economic issues or the ACT UP, the gay rights activists during the 80s were going around a lot. But the police forces in these three cities are really militarized, and they have been since the 60s. So I just found it very unfortunate that the OWS people kind of put themselves in a bad position. I'm not blaming them, but I don't understand why they were as confrontational against that Oakland police force as they were.
But the area has always had more confrontation than other parts of the country. After all, the Black Panthers come from Oakland and
the
Bay Area.
That's right. And
we just did a thing on gun laws in which we learned that conservatives supported gun laws in California during Ronald Reagan's governorship because they were concerned about the Black Panthers.
Right. And that's a sort of, you know, a twisty dynamic. But yes, absolutely. I write in Uncovering Race about when I was a child. I was born in San Francisco in 1963. And by the time I was, you know, 7 and 8 years old, I was very aware of all the activity that was happening around us because it was like virtually nonstop. And, you know, it was not only the Black Panthers, it was the Weathermen would blow up buildings in San Francisco, and the Symbionese Liberation Army was was lurking around, and they kidnapped Patricia
Berkeley
Hearst.
Berkeley was seen as a hotbed of activism.
That's right. And it was action-packed. And I began reading newspapers really at a young age, almost instinctively, because I wanted to sort of try and understand what was going on.
But hadn't that largely died down by the time you became a reporter?
Well, somewhat. I mean, as I said, when I was working at the Examiner in the from 88 to the end of 89, most of the activism on the streets in the Bay Area at that time was from ACT UP or from another group called Food Not Bombs that are homeless activists. And, you know, I covered protests in City Hall Plaza on Venice Avenue in front of City Hall, where the cops would come through and literally just sweep out all the homeless people that had gathered there. It could be very brutal, you know.
And there you are at the Examiner, and you relayed a tricky exchange between you and an editor of yours at
That's
the
right.
newspaper, where he calls you into his office and lets you know that there have been budget cuts and you've been let go. But it's okay because, he said, you're young, a woman, and Black. You'll surely find another job.
That's right. And I was
you must
so,
have been thrilled to hear that.
I was so upset. Talk about a backhanded compliment, right? And I was so deflated, you know, and I went later after I left his office and had a conversation the next day with a guy who at that time, a gentleman who was the managing editor, who's a sort of a legendary old-fashioned newspaper man named Frank McCulloch, who coincidentally is a dead ringer for George C. Scott's version of General Patton. But Frank brought me into his office and we had a very frank talk, and he said, you know, that this is not the appropriate path we should be on, and we need people like you who are A, from San Francisco, B, who are so-called non-traditional, and who are really good. But, you know, we make these gestures, we make these tentative efforts, and then we abandon them. So my recommendation is that you take a job elsewhere and do really, really well and get the experience that will make you be a really great journalist.
So how long before you got the next job? Was that Miami Herald?
No, the next job was at a McClatchy paper in the Central Valley called the Fresno Bee. There are three bees, Modesto,
Sacramento.
Sacramento is the queen bee. And I was at the middle bee, which is the Fresno Bee. And I worked there for 3 years, and that actually was the better course because I had more opportunity to stretch and
How
grow.
Did you survive in Fresno? I've been to Fresno in the summertime when it goes 105 degrees every day at 1 o'clock.
That's right, but it's a dry heat. There's no humidity.
I didn't like
well,
it.
Well, I, you know, part of the reason why I chose Fresno, and that was because I could drive home to San Francisco every weekend. So I did that a lot.
So you established yourself there again, and that allowed you to move on to bigger and better newspapers?
I did. I went from the Bee to the Miami Herald, and that was very exciting. And
was the Miami Herald more ethnically diverse?
Yes. The Miami Herald is unique, and, you know, a lot of it has to do with two things, primarily. Where it is located, obviously South Florida is very ethnically diverse, heavily Hispanic and Latino. And the second reason why the Herald at that time was really a newsroom that truly was ethnically diverse is because the Knight Ridder Corporation, which doesn't exist anymore, which is sort of shocking to consider because they also owned the Philadelphia Daily News, and it was a great newspaper company for a long time.
And weren't they the only company to question, as journalists, the lead-up to the war in Iraq?
Absolutely. Yeah, their D.C.
bureau. Did that hurt them?
No, not really. In fact, it really gained them a lot of respect, certainly among journalists and among government officials who kind of had been, you know, doing their tap dance. But the Knight Ridder papers, which are now the McClatchy Company, bought Knight Ridder, dug up a lot of interesting and meaningful information around the run-up to the war. But in the 90s, when I was at the Miami Herald, it was extremely diverse. The Knight Ridder Corporation did more than just give lip service about ethnic diversity. They really believed in it. And so the newsroom there had a number of high-ranking, really highly skilled and dedicated journalists of, you know, Latino and who were Latino or Black or Asian all throughout the organization.
My guest is Amy Alexander. Her book, Uncovering Race, A Black Journalist's Story of Reporting and Reinvention. But the Herald also had a rather turbulent relationship with the citizens of Miami, didn't it?
It did. And that was a kind of interesting dynamic to observe and also be involved in. You know, South Florida is very kinetic, and it can be volatile. You know, right before I went to the Herald in the early 90s, there had been two or three years in which police were accused of brutalizing Blacks in, you know, Liberty City, Little Haiti, which are two sort of historically Black neighborhoods in Miami proper. So there were a couple of riots that had happened right before I arrived there. There is a very solidly established Cuban-American community, which people might be familiar with, that's very politically active, very economically established. And there's also a very large and prosperous and well-educated South American community, individuals who come from Colombia or Venezuela. And it's very rich and busy. And, you know, then there are the retirees, the snowbirds who come from the Northeast. A lot of Jewish Americans are there. And the Caribbean Blacks who don't really see themselves as all the time aligned with American Blacks. So it can be really contentious.
And I'd imagine a newspaper trying to
navigate
between the different parts of the Cuban community, for example, left and right. Then, as you say, it's also Miami's also a southern city.
That's right.
So yeah, did the word come from on top? Did the McClatchy Company tell people at the Miami Herald how it viewed racial politics?
No. And when I was there, it was owned by the Knight Ridder Corporation. But the leadership of both companies, you know, their goal is to have a battalion of journalists who are straight down the middle, who, you know, with fear or favor to none in terms of how they cover issues. You know, there have been missteps and hiccups over the years. I recount in a situation after I'd left the Herald where the sister paper, which is called El Nuevo Herald, the Spanish language paper, was some of the individuals there were literally on the payroll of an arm of the Bush administration that was essentially doing propaganda against the government in Cuba. So that was like a little cell within El Nuevo Herald that was exposed, and the McClatchy leadership cut it off and said, we absolutely cannot have this kind of an arrangement. But the ownership of both, you know, whether it was McClatchy, whether it's McClatchy now or Knight Ridder in the past, you know, they tried to sort of just do their jobs, which is to cover the news.
Thank you. My guest is Amy Alexander, who's an award-winning content producer. She's worked at a wide range of newspapers, including Miami Herald, the Boston Globe, Village Voice, Washington Post. She's been at The Nation. She's also written for Salon and TheRoot.com. Was associate professor of Tell Me More with Michelle Martin.
Associate producer, yes.
On NPR. And has written a number of books. The most recent is the one that we are discussing right now, which is called Uncovering Race, A Black Journalist's Story of Reporting and Reinvention. It's published by Beacon Press. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Amy Alexander, her latest book, Uncovering Race, A Black Journalist's Story of Reporting and Reinvention, which is published by Beacon Press. There was a time when there was a thriving black newspaper business. We had the Amsterdam News here in New York. There was the Pittsburgh Courier, which was one of the most prestigious and respected newspapers in America. Was that the way that most black journalists at that time got into the business?
Absolutely. It was a function of segregation. But it also, it's interesting you mention this because last night I had dinner with some friends here in New York, and someone asked me about, you know, well, why didn't you, you know, why didn't you go work at the Black Press? And I said, well, because I wanted to make a living. And also I wanted to have, you know, a wide readership as possible.
They did have low circulation, and it's gotten worse over the years.
It has gotten worse. But, you know, America has long had a very dynamic collection of ethnic publications. You know, here, I don't have to tell you, here in New York, there have been scores and scores, and there still are, of ethnic publications. And the Black Press, though, was really distinguished beginning in about, well, after World War One, you know, when there were these riots that would happen in cities because so many soldiers were coming back from the wars and they were resisting the Jim Crow laws that were on the books then. And so the Black Press really stepped up and began to cover these incidents, riots in Oklahoma and St. Louis, where black people were being sort of, you know, put down because some white people who felt that the soldiers were coming back and being too uppity and were causing too many problems. So the Black Press really kind of had its heyday, I would say, roughly between, you know, 1920 and the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement. What happened in that moment is that when the riots of the 60s began to happen over civil rights issues, over police brutalities in the big cities like Chicago and Cleveland and Los Angeles and Detroit, a lot of the traditional news organizations began to realize that they had not really been covering the issues and people in these communities accurately and fairly. And that was spurred also by the Kerner Commission, a big report that came out in, I believe, 68, that laid it all out. You know.
Do you think that most of the newspapers have responded favorably to pressures to be more diverse?
You know, there was a period. It's like when I began in newspapers in the 80s, there really was an effort. You know, Frank McCulloch and other mentors I've had over the years, and certainly myself and many of my peers, recognized that maybe some of the efforts were not that, you know, didn't have a lot of depth. But at the very least, some of the larger newspaper companies, a few of which have gone away now, I mentioned the Knight Ridder News Corporation, which doesn't exist anymore, they really had programs designed to locate, recruit, train, and retain young journalists like me who maybe previously would not be sort of invited into the tent. Internship programs, mentorship programs, and a lot of those have gone away now.
Well, how were internships viewed back when you first started in the business?
Oh, they were viewed as legitimate training grounds.
Well, we don't get many applications from African Americans who would like to work as interns on our show. We start off with an internship and then people wind up, if everything could work out, getting a job either here or elsewhere. And mm-hmm. A lot of our alums have done very well in the business. We do represent a very good entry level to the broadcast world. Mm-hmm. And yet the majority of people who apply are white. Some people say it's because if you're young and a talented black journalist getting out of J school, you're going to be snatched up. well-off students can financially withstand the internship experience, and often poor people
right.
can't.
I would say that's a big piece of it. I mean, I kind of very fleetingly, you know, looked around at KQED when I was finishing college, and you know, I needed to be able to work at a salary that I could support myself, and I think that dynamic it probably is still at play for many young journalists of color. But also now, I think what's happening is that you know, the changes in the news business across the board that have been spurred by the internet have opened up this whole new world of web publications and multimedia enterprises. The pay at them probably isn't that great, but my sense is that a lot of young people of whatever color are feeling like, I will have more freedom, I can be more creative. And certainly with the niching of the news business online, you know, if someone only has an interest really in sports, you can go work in any number of places for free or next to free and really spend a lot of time learning, getting your journeyman experience. So I think maybe there are just more options now also.
Do you think readers care whether the person whose byline is A. Alexander is white or black, male or female?
That's a really good question.
99% of the time, they're not even going to be aware of it, are they?
They're not aware of it. But I think the way that question may enter the mind of readers is if there is something in that report that doesn't sit well with them. And in my experience, as a reporter, when I would meet people out on the beat, sometimes they would express surprise that I was African American. Other times it would be relief. But, you
know, 'cause they thought you'd be more sympathetic to their
right.
side of the story.
That's right, or at least more open-minded. And my goal, though, was always to just get the story right and to convey it in a way that was compelling, that would engage readers. You know, it's all about communication. It's journalism is the process of verification. It's not really terribly mysterious, and it's not rocket science. But to do it appropriately and to do it effectively every single day, it does take a really high level of skill and concentration, because over time what you want to be able to develop are the skills to not only get all the facts right, but to arrange them in a way that achieves the maximum impact in terms of what really is going on, conveying that to readers. And I think, you know, readers don't care the color or ethnic or economic or ethnic makeup of the person. They just want the story to engage them.
It's different on television, mm-hmm. where we notice that the reporter who sent to Chinatown is Asian, or mm-hmm. the reporter who is sent to cover some crime story in a black community is black, mm-hmm. Or isn't black.
Right. And I think whether it's broadcast or print now or the web digital world, what is most important, the strand of positions that really should have more inclusion ethnically and economically, is the management level, the gatekeeper level, because the people who decide what gets covered and how much time or how much space will be devoted to any story or issue really that's the layer that really requires expansive thinking and open-mindedness and a willingness to let different ideas and experiences in the door.
Although it's also pointed out that where a story is placed can be very important.
That's
if you
right.
put a story on page one, it gets a different kind of attention than if it's buried on page 28.
That's right. And, you know, the web has really upended a lot of these old dynamics of the way the news business was. Placement, it still matters on the web. But, for example, if you look at the front page of the New York Times every day on the web, they are almost constantly rearranging their front page lineup. And the updating of every story is virtually minute by minute. So I think there's more openness now, thanks to the web, in terms of how stories get positioned and which issues sort of rise to the top.
My guest is Amy Alexander. Her latest book, Uncovering Race, A Black Journalist's Story of Reporting and Reinvention, published by Beacon Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You call yourself a journalist, but now aren't people being called content producers?
I know. I go back and forth.
Do you like that name?
I tag myself that on my online column, which is called Community Forum, almost with tongue in cheek. It's somewhat of a running gag amongst my peer group that to call yourself now a journalist is almost the same as having an AOL email account address. And so you've got to sort of have these, you know, multimedia producer titles or, you know, content producer, because the rules are changing, the labels are changing, and but basically it's journalism is journalism.
But yeah, but
no matter the
word journalism suggests that you are trying to be as objective as possible. Whereas if you're a content producer, you can be speaking to just one like-minded group.
Well, I suppose that's one interpretation.
I mean, you wouldn't call certain people journalists. You would call them, in fact, some of them call themselves entertainers, even though they're only talking about politics.
Well, that's true. That's true. I consider myself a content producer with tongue-in-cheek, because communication to me is really what the goal is, clear communications. And journalism is the core of that. It's the fundamental, you know, it's the center of that. But, you know, I mean, my day job now is public relations. I work at a lobbying firm, you know, that pays my bills. And I made that decision very consciously, because the volatility in the news business is something that I can't function that way. I have to have a stable position. So, but
you mean,
newspapers
going out of business on a regular basis. The LA Times, one of America's great newspapers, now pared down to something slightly embarrassing.
That's right. And in Washington, D.C., where I'm based, I mean, in the last 5 years. 6 years that I've lived in Washington, D.C., I mean, there are a number of venerable news organizations that have closed their D.C. operations. So, I mean, I am a journalist. I am a journalist, but I have to do a variety of versions of journalism.
Stephen Colbert pointed out that on the day that the story about what happened in Oakland was on all the newspapers, the front pages of all newspapers, the Washington Post published a picture of an Oakland policeman petting a kitty cat. That was the only photograph they had of a cop in Oakland that day. Now, that's another way that we can also affect the telling of the story.
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
and that's the Washington Post.
That's the Washington Post. And I'm pretty sure they updated that page within that news cycle. I don't think that image was the prevailing image for the entirety of that news cycle. I could be wrong.
I hope you're right.
Yeah, but no, it's a very sort of unsettled time right now in the news business. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with this. But my belief is that, you know, the more variety you have of people that are delivering the news, the better you're serving your viewers or listeners or readers.
Well, you mentioned that the internet is changing everything, but right now nobody knows how that's going to work completely, because advertising is still not really able to support a complete news operation.
That's right.
But and we're seeing activism-based internet news more and more.
Yes, and to me that has been the most fascinating, kind of in a philosophical way. You know, the economics of what's happened in the news business is what is really at the bottom of the turbulence. But the ascension of news organizations, quote in quotation marks, that are purely partisan, but which by all other intents and purposes look and have a feel almost in terms of their tone of being a news organization, has been fascinating to me. Talking Points Memo, you know, Slate and Salon are all very, you know, they're the writers and the editors there are highly skilled, but they are not delivering news and information. They're delivering very partisan coverage. And I'm not quite sure what to make of it. It makes me somewhat nervous, though, kind of inherently, because I was trained in college and then my first 10 years in journalism to just be reporting the news in a straight manner.
Well, do you think that that our consciousness of race, as it's reported, has continued to change? For example, after Hurricane Katrina, that seemed to be a wake-up call. Do you think that affected the way the earthquake in Haiti was covered?
I do, and I chart this. I do an analysis of this in Uncovering Race. In the coverage of Katrina, it was this very sort of strange lag in that first 3 or 4 days right after the hurricane, where it was so obvious from the images, purely from an image standpoint, that the largest population of residents in New Orleans who had really been damaged and harmed and put in harm's way were poor Black people. And yet none of the news coverage was pointing that out. And so
we're mostly talking about people with guns.
Yes. The stories that kind of rose to the top of the national to the national level were about the, you know, supposed nefarious goings on in the Superdome,
and looting
and so forth. And, you know, some photos were circulated of white people carrying goods through the floodwaters, and they were referred to as having, you know, collected survival goods, but the Black people were referred to as being looting. So there was this weird, you know, and it's tumultuous. I mean, I've covered disasters live, and it can just be really crazy. But there were some gaps, and only after a writer at Slate, who's actually no longer at Slate, Jack Schaefer, pointed out in a column probably about a week and a half after the hurricane that why aren't people pointing out that essentially Black people are being left to drown in this city? Why is no one saying that? What is the fear of this? And then that kind of opened a floodgate, metaphorically speaking, of coverage from blogs and from other writers saying, oh, yes, now that you mention it, what's up with the Bush administration? How could this be the case? So that was very interesting. I think lessons were learned from that. I think there's a heightened sensitivity in news organizations, certainly the big news organizations. You know, The Washington Post, which is my home, quote-unquote, hometown paper, is really smart. They have a deep bench of very highly skilled journalists of color all throughout their organization. It's both a function of their location. Washington's a very Black city, obviously. But it's also because the ownership of that paper really believes that it makes economic good sense, and it makes good sense in terms of their editorial, their ability to cover the region. So they do a very good job of integrating their editorial ranks. The Times, I think, does a good job. They have a deep bench of highly skilled journalists of color. Although I must say that the art section of the New York Times just gives me fits every time I read it. And, you know, I don't want to get too inside baseball, but I really wish that that desk were more diverse. I see big gaps in their coverage all the time. And I personally find it problematic, and I don't understand why that is.
Well, maybe you're going to have to come back with a follow-up.
Maybe.
Amy Alexander's latest book is called Uncovering Race, A Black Journalist's Story of Reporting and Reinvention. It's published by Beacon Press. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you. I had fun.
Something K-Part.